childless, that was considered something to be ashamed of, and an example that you were out of favor with God. And of course, remember, Job has lost his whole family. So it's kind of cruel that Eliphaz says this. But listen, we'll read through it. Pretty much it's all true. Everything that Eliphaz says, it just doesn't apply to Job. The wicked man, that's the key phrase. What he's talking about, all of these things describe a person. Okay, once again, what does wicked mean? Yeah. Wickedness isn't just, you know, you're too stupid to, and you tripped and you sinned. Wickedness is a person who sees what's right clearly, sees what's wrong clearly, and deliberately chooses the wrong. And God is unbelievably merciful to people who will repent, even wicked people. But when we choose what's wrong over what's right, there's only one place that road is going, unless we change our direction, which is what repentance means. So these are all true things. The wicked man writhes with pain all of his days, and the number of years is hidden from the wicked man. Dreadful sounds are in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer comes upon you. Now, these little jabs are getting more and more pointed, because he's looking at Job, and Job is writhing in pain, and all Job lost everything right in the middle of prosperity, so he's positive this all applies to Job. The wicked man does not believe that he will return from the darkness, because a sword is waiting for him. That's speaking of guilt and paranoia. You know, he's afraid of the dark because he's just sure that he's going to get caught. He wanders about for bread, saying, "Where is it?" This is the guy who used to be prosperous. A wicked man knows that a day of darkness is ready at his hand. Trouble and anguish make him afraid. Interesting. Job really was not afraid through all of this, was he? In fact, he gets less afraid the farther he goes, because he realizes who is doing the evil that's been done to him. He realizes how off the wall these guys are, and he realizes he doesn't have anything against God, and his fear. Actually, by the way, the biggest remedy for fear is simply to abandon yourself to God's will. Stop fighting. And it's the biggest remedy for fear that there is. So here, Eliphaz is accusing him of being a wicked man, and wicked men are filled with fear. Verse 24, they overpower him. That's trouble and anguish, like a king ready for battle. Because he stretches out his hand against God and acts defiantly against the Almighty, running stubbornly against him with his strong embossed shield. You almost can picture Don Quixote, you know, with his armor, and, you know, he's going to joust with the windmill, and Eliphaz is saying, you know, you're just like all other wicked men trying to fight God. You're going to lose. Verse 27, though he has covered his face with his fatness and made his waist heavy with fat. Makes you wonder. Of course, Job is not overweight now, because he's, you know, his body is severely afflicted, but what I see behind a lot of the stuff that these guys say, I see jealousy. Job was more blessed than any other person on the face of the earth. And it makes you wonder, were they jealous about that? Because he sure didn't flaunt it. He was a generous person. He had no sense of entitlement at all. Job didn't. And yet he's being accused of stuff in his face. He, the wicked man, dwells in desolate cities, verse 28. The word desolate means God forsaken. In houses which no one inhabits. No sound of partying at the birthdays of Job's children. They're all dead. He dwells in desolate cities, houses which no one inhabits, which are destined to become ruins. He will not be rich, nor will his wealth continue, nor will his possessions overspread the earth. He will not depart from darkness. The flame will dry out his branches, and by the breath of God's mouth, he will go away. Kind of an interesting, I don't know if you remember in chapters 1 and 2, but remember when the whirlwind or whatever it was that came and knocked down the house that Job's family was in, it killed them all, that was called the breath of God. And when the lightning struck, it was called the fire of God. So he's thinly veiled allusions to what has happened to Job. Let him not trust in futile things. Deceiving himself for futility will simply be his reward. It will be accomplished before his time, and his branch will not be green. Now, all of these phrases in the next three or four verses are all figurative language for the curse that's on somebody so that they can't reproduce. They will have no offspring. I cannot imagine anybody saying they're somebody's friends and then digging the knife in when you're still grieving about the loss of your children. I can't even imagine that. He will shake off his unripe grape like a vine and cast off his blossom like an olive tree, for the company of hypocrites will be barren, and fire will consume the tents of bribery. They conceive only trouble, that is, wicked people, and bring forth only futility. Their womb prepares only deceit. So, thank you, Eliphaz, for being such a good friend. I think it's interesting that in chapter 37, when God steps on the scene, which is, like I said, half a day away, chronological time, the very first person that God talks to is Eliphaz. He says, you are wrong. You are just, nothing you said about me, Eliphaz, was right. Job was right. Man, I wish God'd step in right now. I was going to sing a song tonight, and I totally forgot we were going to sing We Must Wait, Wait, Wait on the Lord, Learn Our Lessons Well. Boy, the story of Job brings that out, doesn't it? 35 chapters, but it only covers about a day of debate and a couple of weeks at the most of Job's suffering, but it seemed interminable, and he really thought it was going to be the whole rest of his life. He had no idea it was all going to change. And he would be vindicated. And in one sense, God would be vindicated against Satan's accusations. So the next two chapters are Job's defense and answer to this, and there are some great things in here. Last episode, Job said one of my favorite things that anybody of faith has ever said in all of the Bible. He said, though he slay me, I'll still hope in him. And at that time, Job's still thinking God did all this stuff to him, and he doesn't know why. But he said, you know, he can kill me. I'm still not going to change. I'm going to still put my hope in him. Man, there's not a lot of that going around, is there? One time, things don't work out the way we like him, and we're just not sure we're going to serve God anymore, and I'm just not going to trust him because we don't get our way. And I look at the way that Job is, and I say, oh, Lord, I want to know you so well that I could lose everything and I would still put my hope in you. It's the only safe place to put your hope, by the way. The title of our study tonight is Where is My Hope? Because it's the very last thing Job says in chapter 17. And we will get there. Hang on. I've got lots of time. So Job answers and says, I have heard many such things. It could also be rendered, I have heard too many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Are you ever going to shut up, is what verse 3 means. Shall words of wind have an end? Here's an interesting question. What provokes you?
Why are you still doing this? I'm trying to defend myself. Why won't you leave me alone? What could your motivation be? That's a really good question. Can I tell you what I think Eliphaz's motivation was? It's the reason why we sang a couple of songs that we sang tonight. Because church people are famous, when their pride gets involved, of caring more about being right than about doing right. We are told to be merciful and gracious to each other. If Job was guilty, and he wasn't, but if he was guilty, it was still the wrong way for these guys to treat him. But when pride kicks in, these people, Eliphaz was just, his pride was hurt because I'm the oldest guy here. You should have listened to me. Rejecting my advice is rejecting God. God and I, we just think just exactly alike. People like that don't give up. So he was worried about was being trying to prove that he was right. He really didn't care about mercy, didn't care about doing right. So what provokes you that you keep answering me? Why is this conversation continuing? Verse 4, I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. That's a true friend. He said, man, really easy to judge me when you have boils all over your body. You didn't just lose everything. I mean, I could do the same thing. If the tables were turned and you lost everything in one day, I could lay some trip on you, but I wouldn't do that. I'm your friend. I would seek to comfort you. I am kind of astonished. I guess I was naive. But I'm amazed that through really hard times in my life, how few people there were that really comforted you. There are always people that want to lecture you. There are guys, especially, who, when things go wrong, the very first words out of their mouth are to tell you what you should have done. Excuse me, I'm bleeding. But their first words out of their mouth is, you shouldn't have done that. You know, you should have done it this way. Job just says, I thought you were my friends. If the tables were turned, I would strengthen you and comfort you and relieve your grief. The Amplified Bible here in verse 6 is great. It says, I hardly know whether to answer you or to just be silent. New King James says, though I speak in my defense, my grief is not relieved. And if I remain silent, how am I eased? It won't help. You almost see him talking to himself, saying, why do I bother? Doesn't help. You know, one of the things I love about Job, in the Bob movie of the book of Job, Job looks exactly like Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. It's my movie. I can make him look like whatever I want. But you know how Tevye would always, in the middle of a conversation, walking down the street, would look up and start talking to God? And you never knew where the conversation with God was being interrupted by people. That's the way Job is. There's something very endearing about that. It tells you something about what his relationship with God was, and it tells you why most of his suffering emotionally was that God wasn't talking to him. It's like they had this thing going for his whole life. And now the one person he most wants to talk to, because you see him all the time, goes back and forth. He's calling out to God right in the middle of the conversation. I like that. So Job looks exactly like Tevye in his little Russian Jewish outfit and probably plays the violin. Who knows? But now he has worn me out. Lord, you have made desolate all my company. It's an interesting word. It simply means everybody that I am associating with now is desolate. Who was the one person in Job's family that Satan didn't kill? It was Job's wife. What do you suppose? Compassion? No. Because she had the closest way to Job's heart, and as she struggled with her own grief at losing all her children, and she lost everything Job lost, and then she had to sit and watch her husband, you know, whose body falling apart, and she didn't have the faith and the strength that Job did, and she just blurted out, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" And Satan allowed the weakness of this woman. Now, in the Bob version of this movie, she learns a lesson and she turns out to be a fabulous godly wife for the next 140 years. That's, he doesn't say it didn't happen. So I'm believing that she learned. But here's Job's three friends, and they turn out to be absolutely, completely devoid of any godly compassion. And you almost can see him looking up, and he said, "I'm just worn out with this. I don't have anybody around me that even has God in them." Ever felt that way? Oh, I know you have. I'll tell you, that has been one of the hardest things. Coming from where I come from, where I spent most of my whole life for 30 years constantly surrounded by Christians. That was my job. And then I came out here where if you run into a Christian ever out in the world once in a year, you want to dance. It's just so fabulous. So what a contrast. You guys that are from someplace else, you know what I mean. That's what Job is saying. He's just looking up in that Tevye tone of voice, and he's saying, "I'm surrounded by godless people." I don't blame him for saying that. Verse 8, "You have shriveled me up." Now, is he talking to Eliphaz or is he talking to God? Because he goes back and forth. I think he's talking to Eliphaz. I think he's just worn out. Because down in verse 11 is where we're going to see the paradigm shift, where Job realizes that it's not God that did this stuff to him, it's the devil. So I think when he's saying, "You have shriveled me up, and it is a witness against me. My leanness rises up against me. The fact that I'm suffering is an indictment against me." How backwards is that? Well, do you know any people that practice the name it and claim it teaching? Don't you dare get sick, because you won't get any comfort from them. They'll say it's your fault. I remember in my first church, we put a wheelchair ramp in our church, and the local name it and claim it guy said that we were insulting God. That if we had God in our church, there wouldn't be any people that needed a wheelchair ramp. And how dare we call ourselves God's church? So Job is just saying, "I can't believe this. All this stuff happened and now it's being used against me." He tears me in his wrath and hates me. He gnashes at me with his teeth. I still think he's talking about Eliphaz. "My adversary sharpens his..." Or he could be talking about Satan, because we know in verse 12, 13, and 14, he does. "They gape at me with their mouth, and they strike me reproachfully on the cheek. They gather together against me." That sounds like he's talking about his friends, doesn't it? Or his so-called friends. So here's the paradigm shift. Verse 11. "God has delivered me to the ungodly one." The only time in the whole Bible this Hebrew word appears. It's the word avil. So glad you're here, Sandra. You can write this down. apostrophe A, V I Y L, Avil. It's one of the names for Satan, the ungodly one, or the wicked one. It has the definite article in front of it. God has delivered me to. Let me read you what my study notes say. The next six verses leave the casual reader at a loss to know of whom Job is speaking, of God, of Eliphaz, or of Satan, each of whom has been the choice of various translators and commentators. But a careful study of the text itself, particularly the 11th verse, seems to leave no question that while Job is blaming God for abandoning him to satanic forces, nevertheless, the monstrous, appalling, disgusting behavior which Job describes is by him being attributed to Satan. Verse 11 in any translation seems to reveal what the reader has known all along, but which Job only now sees. He still doesn't understand God's motive, but he is facing the facts as they are. He is at the mercy of Satan. But God's thrilling and rewarding motive for allowing it is still unknown to him. So here's the paradigm shift. God has delivered me to the Avil, the ungodly one. And by the rules of interpretation, the next few he's are applying to Satan. And of course, my Amplified Bible puts that in brackets. I was at ease, but he, Satan, has shattered me. He, Satan, also has taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces. We had a rat terrier when I was a kid. And that thing, you know where terriers are? They'll grab a rodent and they'll just shake it and shake it. They'll shake it to death. And Job's saying, yeah, that's what Satan did to me. This is interesting. He has set me up for his target and his archers surround me. Ever felt like that? Boy, when all the really bad stuff was happening here about 6 years ago, just the hardest things in my whole life. I remember one day going for a long walk out by the beach and just saying, Lord, I just feel like I'm being shot at. And he said, you are. Shoot back. And then I realized, well, wait a minute, who's shooting at me? Do I need to start firing back at people? And then I remember that scripture that says it's not flesh and blood that we're fighting against. We got to remember that, folks. People aren't our enemy. Satan's our enemy. But have you ever felt like he just set you up for a target and invited all of his friends and say, okay, there he is. Here I am, you know, just like when we had our skeet shoot target thing. Here's the outline of Bob, you know, big target on my chest, and whoever gets right at my heart gets the most points. Man, I have felt like that. He pierces my heart and does not pity. That's a good thing to remember about the devil, folks. He does not play fair.